Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have a fabulous show today on something really, really important and in the cutting edge of what we want to be thinking about, and that is thinking about TEE for the non-cardiac anesthesiologist. And I have a perfect guest to talk about this today. Dr. Andreas Plakas is a Vanderbilt-trained cardiac anesthesiologist and the creator and host of the first-of-its-kind perioperative transesophageal echo podcast called TEE Time, which I highly recommend you check out. Of course, we'll have links in the show notes. He's a board-certified anesthesiologist, also cardiac anesthesiologist, and he's board certified in advanced perioperative transesophageal echo and critical care echo, and in full-time clinical practice in Arkansas. He trained at Vanderbilt, as I said, and now practices near his family in Arkansas. I'm thrilled to have him on the show. Andreas, welcome to ACRAC.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So tell me a little bit about you, how you got interested in TEE, not just as any old cardiac anesthesiologist who, you know, of course, is going to use it, but how did you develop an interest that took you all the way to starting a podcast about it? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so TEE has been a passion of mine for a number of years. I think specifically as it relates to the podcast, it dates back to the start of my cardiac anesthesia fellowship at Vanderbilt. At that time, what's unique about cardiac surgical cases is, in addition to prepping for all the other things like anesthesia considerations or surgical considerations, you need to learn how to use TEE to help in those cases, such as what to do in the pre-bypass period when you're on cardiopulmonary bypass or in the post-bypass period. During fellowship, one thing I had difficulty with was finding concise, high-yield resources to help me prepare for TEE during those cases. Essentially, finding resources that say, here's what you need to know if you're performing a mitral valve replacement, or, you know, if that's being performed by the surgeon, an aortic valve replacement, heart transplant, lung transplant, here's what you need to know. So because of some of that difficulty, I took on this big educational project during my fellowship where I made this big written manual that was summarizing perioperative TEE considerations for really all kinds of different cardiac surgery cases. And by the end of the year, I want to say it was over 60 pages long, you know, one page for each type of surgery. And that document is still used by trainees at that institution today. But over the years, being out in practice, I've added to it. And I've always had this itch, wondering what it would be like if I added video and commentary to this written content to essentially bring it to life. And so that's how the idea for the Tea Time podcast was born from there.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I love that, especially just as an example of when you have that interest, you know, and you kind of think, oh, you know, I would love to be able to disseminate this or help people with this, or I just really passionate about this, you know, find a way to capitalize on that. You know, a lot of people, I have a lot of residents who kind of think, well, yeah, I don't love traditional research, so I guess academics is not for me. And I'll tell them, you know, first of all, academics or no academics, finding an area of interest is going to make your career more rewarding. And if you are interested in academics, it doesn't have to be traditional research. You know, do a podcast, do a, you know, make some modules, make a manual, right? I mean, there's lots of ways you can do teaching and make curriculum that isn't traditional research. And so you have found a way to take that interest in TEE that's not just in using it clinically, but in kind of teaching it and disseminating knowledge about it. And you've made this podcast, which is fabulous. And as I said, I really recommend people check it out.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah. So let's talk about, obviously the cardiac anesthesiologist is going to use TEE all the time, but what about the non-cardiac anesthesiologist? Tell us a little bit about where you see TEE being useful for the non-cardiac anesthesiologist.
Yeah. So there's a few specific areas that I can think of, specifically in high risk non-cardiac surgeries. I think of any time there's a risk of significant hemodynamic compromise during a surgery, there's select types of trauma surgery, high risk vascular surgeries, certain transplant surgeries. But anytime you can think, would my patient potentially be at high risk of hemodynamic compromise? I know we'll talk about the next one later, but the next one is emergent cases or emergent situations where it can be used as a rescue tool for managing patients with severe hypotension and cardiac arrest. I will say as well, it's worth mentioning that for trainees, specifically anesthesia residents, TEE is on the content outline for the OSCE portion of the ABA applied exam. So if for no other reason, this is something that could be showing up on future tests for that group of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there a role for non-anesthesiologists to be using TE, do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think the scope of practice is always changing and evolving. Two groups that I would mention would be the emergency department physicians. I frequently see it used and taught more in those settings. And in the operating settings, we call it rescue TE when we use it in emergencies. But in emergency departments, it's known as resuscitative TE. So that's one area where it's growing. And then the other area is with intensivists in clinical practice that are seeking more and more formal training. For example, I know a few pulmonology intensivists that came out of training with no familiarity with TE that have gone and sought their own formal training. And now they use it in the care of critically ill patients as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I was not aware that this was being used in the emergency department. I don't think it's yet made an appearance on the PIT, but I'm sure it's only a matter of time.
Because it's so useful, I can imagine that as the scope changes, it's one of those things that we'll see more and more.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. And it makes a lot of sense for ED docs, at least in you know, busy trauma centers, in the ICUs, even for non-anesthesiologists. So, I mean, it all makes sense that this should be done. Now, the question that of course, is going to be on a lot of anesthesiologists and trainees' minds is, you know, why do I need TEE if I have TTE, right? We kind of think of, and I think a lot of people talk about, transthoracic echo as the real tool of the non-cardiac anesthesiologist, being able to use this in the ICU. We do it all the time, of course. So what's your answer to that? Why would someone need TEE if they have TTE?
Yeah, well, I'll speak specifically to the perioperative setting because there's a lot of indications, you know, outpatient indications, all that. But I'll speak specifically to perioperative settings. Comparing the two, some of the advantages of TEE would be thinking of your views. Frequently, you're able to obtain views faster and in most settings obtain superior quality views, especially in patient populations such as patients with high BMI, open chest or chest wall injuries where putting a TTE probe might not be feasible to obtain views. And then I mentioned in emergency settings, some of the advantages in those settings would be the ability to monitor a patient hands-free. So what you can do is place a TE probe, get your view on the screen, and then continue to do other things to help care for a patient in an emergency. Whereas with a TTE probe, you have to hold a hand or dedicate a hand to holding that TTE probe on the chest wall, and you're unable to do other things while you're doing that specifically. Another part worth mentioning in emergencies is that TEE does not interrupt CPR, which is an important quality of high quality chest compressions, is minimal interruptions if possible. I think the last thing that I can think of is for procedural guidance, especially keeping in mind mechanical circulatory support. TEE is very helpful for locating wires, positioning cannulas, or other types of devices as well.
Yeah. And I can't tell you how many times certainly in the OR, we think, wouldn't it be great to be able to put a transthoracic probe on, but it's under the drapes, they're prone, you know, whatever it may be. And then in the ICU, also, there's a lot of times where you have a patient they have dressings on their chest, you just can't get good windows through the chest, they've got a big abdominal incision that's high enough that you can't do a subcostal. You know, there's a lot of times in both the OR and the ICU where you can't use a TTE, but presumably, many of those, you could use a TEE. Now, let me ask you, I remember years ago, there was this idea that we would at some point have sort of lower profile TEE probes, you know, that weren't as big, that you could maybe leave in for a more extended period of time, like in the ICU. Are those in use, or are we really just still dealing with what I used as a resident on cardiac, the kind of standard big TEE probe?
Yeah, I can't speak specifically to those because I've never personally used them, but I'm aware of devices that are made, one, with smaller profile, especially for patients that have things like esophageal strictures. Some people call them pediatric TE probes. And then there's some, you see some studies out there where they talk about leaving a probe in for up to 72 hours, and certain disposable TE probes are made for that purpose as well. I haven't seen those implemented in clinical practice, but they're definitely out there.
Okay. Yeah, I imagine we might see more of that over time. Let's talk about Rescue TEE. What does that mean, and what are the goals of Rescue TEE?
Hey, folks, I just want to take a second to shout out our rockstar returning sponsor, TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. And now you can create flashcards, which are a key tool for high-quality studying and maximizing test performance. The education research is clear that spaced repetition with these kind of tools is the best way to learn and retain information. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAG to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAG.
All right, and now we're back talking about Rescue TEE.
Rescue TEE is something that I'm passionate about. I even dedicated a three-part series in my podcast to it, episodes 15, 16, and 17. But think about Rescue TEE as a problem-focused TEE exam where you can, in emergencies, you can diagnose pathology, guide interventions, and even monitor a therapeutic response. And specifically for patients with unexplained persistent hypotension, hypoxemia, or cardiac arrest. And the major goals of performing this exam are to help differentiate the type of shock and possible causes for that shock. So that's the goal when we're thinking about using Rescue TEE. And I'll reiterate that it is not a comprehensive exam. It's a problem-focused exam because the goal here is to make a diagnosis, an accurate diagnosis, as quickly as possible. So speed matters in these exams.
Yeah, and that, you know, I think most trainees these days are going to be familiar with that because really in the ICUs, that's what we do with the TTE, right? We rarely are doing a complete exam. We are saying, okay, you know, I need to know about volume status. So I'm going to look at a couple quick things, or I'm worried there could be tamponade. I'm going to just look for a pericardial effusion really quick, right? Or I'm worried about right heart failure. I'm going to quickly see what the right heart looks like, as opposed to going through the entire cardiac echo. So that, not that no one can do that, and certainly people are trained to do that, as you are and can, but often we're using a very targeted approach. And so that's what it sounds like you're talking about too.
Yep, exactly.
How about perioperatively? How are we thinking about using this perioperatively versus, let's say, like an out-of-hospital arrest?
Yeah, so there's a few unique considerations specific to the perioperative period. The first one I think of is imagine someone laying down in a field. This is out of hospital arrest compared to in the OR setting. Patients have witnessed arrests. They're on monitors and there's abundant resources all around. So this often will lead to more timely diagnoses and treatment. They're oftentimes in an ideal state already, which is intubated, sedated, and paralyzed. So they're ready for TE placement. It is worth mentioning that if it's a sedation type case, you know, MAC case, or if there's an LMA in place, it is safer to exchange that for an endotracheal tube prior to using TEE. So you have a definitive airway. You can use it safely. The other things would be positioning in the OR setting compared to an out-of-hospital setting. Patients could be prone, they could be lateral, there could be difficult access to them if a bed is spun 180 degrees, or even thinking about surgical drapes or equipment that may affect access to the patient. And I'd say the last thing that is a major difference is thinking through the differential diagnosis, where in the perioperative setting, you oftentimes will have anesthesia or surgery-related adverse events causing a cardiac arrest compared to something like ischemic heart disease, which would be much higher on the differential for an out-of-hospital arrest.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. And then where are you thinking, yeah, this is like a really good candidate for it, and who are candidates that you would say just that's contraindicated, we can't do it? I mean, I guess one obvious one is esophageal stricture, that kind of thing. But, you know, what else do you think about?
Yeah, so we're thinking about indications, contraindications. The indications, which I touched on briefly, would be any unexplained persistent hypotension, hypoxemia, or cardiac arrest, and then also things like new arrhythmias or ischemic EKG changes. As far as when a TE probe should not be placed. Overall, it's worth mentioning that this is a generally a very safe procedure. There's a up to 1 to 2% rate of complications and a less than 0.1% chance of any major complications such as an esophageal perforation or major bleeding. Some of the absolute contraindications worth mentioning would be major esophageal or gastric injuries or obstructions or acute bleeding in those sites. There are a number of relative contraindications as well. And these, especially in a rescue setting, these deserve a thorough risk versus benefit evaluation, because especially if a patient's coding, there may be a whole lot of benefit you can offer. And that risk versus benefit analysis may look different compared to, you know, just in a planned surgery.
Yeah. And it seems to me like one of the classic times we think about wanting to place a Swan in the ICU is that undifferentiated shock. We're trying to figure out, is this cardiogenic or is this septic or is it both? And this seems like a great substitute for Swan. If you can get that idea, you should be able to tell if there's a cardiogenic component or if it isn't, right? If the heart is hyperdynamic and looks great, but they're, you know, have profound hypotension, it's much more likely to be septic. So that seems like a great use. Let's talk about the rescue exam itself. So what are you looking at? How are you doing it?
Yeah, and maybe I can even touch on what you just mentioned, the types of shock and all that, even because I think it sets up well a framework for how to think about the TE imaging protocols, if that's all right with you.
Of course.
Yeah. Let me. So as far as thinking through the different types of shock and causes of cardiac arrest, like some of what you mentioned, there's a number of different ways that are taught. Some, you think back even to med school, thinking through the H's and T's of cardiac arrest and memorizing that list that was 10 and now it's 12 and going through all of those. You mentioned those types of shock, the four types like hypovolemic, distributive, cardiogenic, obstructive. One thing that helps me in a rescue TE setting is trying to think as anatomically as possible. So understanding cardiac anatomy and thinking through, essentially with my rescue exam, I'm looking anatomically at the heart to try and understand what's going on. So I use the acronym PCAR, and you may have heard this, but it stands for preload, contractility, afterload, rate, and rhythm. Now, these are all factors that influence cardiac output. So if one of them is very abnormal, it can lower cardiac output or blood pressure. And the only thing, instead of memorizing a big list, all I have to think about and know is I ask the question, how does blood flow through the heart and the body, and where can things go wrong in that pathway? So how does blood flow through the heart and the body, and where can things go wrong in that pathway? And for each of these terms, the left ventricle is the reference point for the entire evaluation. So thinking anatomically, preload here would be considered factors preventing blood from reaching the left ventricle. And a distinction to make would, most people, when they think of preload, they think of only hypovolemia, but RV failure as well would cause low preload to the left ventricle. Contractility is considered contractility would be defined as LV factors like global or regional LV dysfunction. Afterload would be factors downstream of the left ventricle, and these could be high or low afterload, or it can also be broken into intracardiac or extracardiac causes. And then just to round it out, rate and rhythm would be a reduced number of adequate stroke volumes per minute. So once we understand some of those terms, I just want you to think with me in your head about the way blood flows through the body and how it can be categorized in each one of these terms, starting in the peripheral circulation, where there could be bleeding or hypovolemia, and then blood travels back to the heart through the IVC or SVC, where there could be compression of those vessels, then into the right atrium, where something like cardiac tamponade could cause chamber compression. Blood flows through the tricuspid valve and then into the right ventricle, where RV failure could be present, through the pulmonic valve into the pulmonary arteries, where pulmonary hypertension or a PE could be obstructing blood flow. Then from the lung, from the pulmonary arteries to the lungs, where something like lung pathology, a tension pneumothorax or auto-PEEP, for example, would cause problems before blood finally heads to the left side of the heart, where mitral valve pathology would be. So that is the framework I have for the preload side of things. And then afterload, I basically just start at the left ventricle and keep the path of blood flow through the LVOT, where LVOT obstruction could be present. Then there's aortic valve pathology, aortic stenosis, aortic regurgitation. Then in that proximal ascending aorta, an aortic dissection could be present.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, ACRackers. One thing I love about summer is how easy everything feels. The days are a little more relaxed, and I find myself reaching for the same comfortable go-anywhere pieces again and again. That's why I keep coming back to Quince. They focus on well-made essentials that naturally become those everyday staples you actually live in all season long. Quince's 100% European linen pants and shirts are breathable, easy to throw on, and the summer upgrade your rotation needs, starting at just $34. Their tees are soft enough to live in all day, and the lightweight cotton sweaters are exactly what you want when the summer nights cool down. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands, and they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen. And it's not just clothing. They have everything from home to travel to everyday essentials. I absolutely love the zip-up fleece I got from Quince. I wear it all the time, and it might be the only thing my wife and daughters actually compliment me on. And it didn't cost anywhere near what I thought it would. Make your summer wardrobe easy. Go to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/ACCRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ACRAC.
Hey there, ACRackers. Hunger strikes and you're exhausted. You want to make something healthy, but you don't have the energy. Sound familiar? For me, eating healthy isn't a willpower problem, it's a setup problem. Or it was until I found Factor. Factor solves the setup problem with fully prepared meals designed by dietitians and crafted by chefs delivered right to your door. My wife and I want to give our kids healthy food that they will actually eat, but we don't have time to cook from scratch. That's why we use Factor, and you should too. Inside your Factor box, you'll find lean proteins, colorful veggies, whole food ingredients, and healthy fats. It's always fresh, never frozen, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and honestly, they're right. Some of our favorites right now are the smoky barbecue chicken breast and the butternut squash sage chicken macaroni. With over 100 rotating weekly meals, there's always something new to look forward to. Plus 70-plus add-ons to round out your nutrition from green juices to peanut butter energy bites. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it, and now I can't get enough. Get Factor, and if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss, you know where to go. Head to factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off and free daily greens per box with new subscription only while supplies last until 9/27/26. See website for more details.
Hey, folks. I wanted to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs. Made for us and humans, these are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all FIGS all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, a medical student, CRNA, or CRNA student, or an anesthesiologist like me. Investing in a couple of pairs of FIGS is totally worth it. We're partnering with FIGS to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. FIGS goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try FIGS today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. That's FIGSRX at checkout.
Hey folks, this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. We talk about mental health more openly now, but asking for help can still feel hard, and BetterHelp's latest research confirms it. BetterHelp's 2026 State of Stigma report surveyed 2,000 Americans and revealed that 85% of Americans believe getting support is wise, yet 74% say society discourages people from doing so. To close this gap between believing it helps and actually seeking it, we have to be willing to encourage our friends and family to get therapy. It's been such a great help to me, and I urge everyone I know to embrace it for themselves too. With over 30,000 therapists who are fully licensed in the U.S., BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 stars for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews, BetterHelp does the initial matching for you so you can focus on therapy goals. And with 12 plus years of experience and an industry-leading match fulfillment rate, they typically get it right the first time. And if you're not happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time. Don't let stigma stand in the way of support. Start therapy with BetterHelp. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
All right, and we're back.
And then you keep traveling, the path of blood out to the periphery again, and think about causes of low after load, the distributive shock, anaphylaxis, neurogenic shock, anesthesia-related vasodilation, or sepsis. So I know that's a wordy way of explaining it, the path of blood flow. But if you can imagine it in your head, you have a framework that's very anatomic, and echo is looking at it anatomically. So I think these ways are really helpful ways to integrate both an exam and a mental framework. So you're not thinking in one train of thought and looking with another when you're using echo. So getting to your question about imaging protocols, what do I actually do when I'm doing a rescue TEE? Well, you'll find a number of different rescue TEE protocols. There's not one true absolute way to do it. I'll share the way that I teach in my podcast, which is a combination of two different published exams. And because I go into so much detail in my podcast, I separate these into three steps, but I'm going to simplify it here into two parts. The first is the initial evaluation. So this is getting three different TEE views and trying to answer the question, is there a problem with preload, contractility, or afterload? And then part two is performing the rest of the complete basic perioperative TEE exam and then other advanced views or maneuvers from here to solidify diagnosis and ensure that there's no finding that's missed. And when you look at images in emergencies, when they're high stress and you can lose some of your footing a little bit, I think systematically evaluating the heart can be a strength. And so when I look at any echo clip in this framework, I think of the words in, at, and around. I want to look in the heart, look at the heart, and look around the heart. So I'm looking in the heart for at volume status and for clots. I'm looking at the heart for LV, RV dysfunction, and looking at the valves. And when I evaluate valves, it's both with and without color flow Doppler. And the valve evaluation here is not I'm trying to discern between mild and moderate. It's trying to make it as black and white as possible. Does the valve open and does it close? Is there good leaflet excursion where there is unlikely to be significant stenosis? And does it close properly? Does it coapt well? And there's no major regurgitant jet. And then I mentioned around. I look around the heart for fluid collections, compression of heart chambers. So looking in, at, and around the heart can be helpful when you look at images.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great way to think about it. And am I right that, like, when you're looking at the valves, you don't need to, not that it wouldn't be fine to do, but you don't need to be kind of, you know, calculating an exact cardiac output or measuring exactly the VTI. I mean, you're really trying to get, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're trying to get an idea of, like, is the problem, right? Because you're not doing rescue TE unless there's a problem. So you have a very hypotensive patient, let's say, or even a resting patient, and you're trying to figure out, is the problem that they have, you know, critical aortic stenosis or wide open MR, right? Like, you're just trying to get, like, yes or no, is this the cause of my problem?
Yeah, I think that's a great point that most times in a rescue setting, especially with severe hypotension or even cardiac arrest, your findings in TE are usually not subtle. You're not teasing out something. It's usually more obvious, and you just need to make the diagnosis quickly and accurately. I will say, depending on how deep and how advanced you want to get into TEE, things like cardiac output and even LVOT, VTI can serve a purpose. And I mentioned, I'll even take you through exactly some of the details of how I do the evaluation, because I think it's up to the provider as far as how many tools do they want in their tool belt when they're performing rescue TEE. But I mentioned in part one of an evaluation, you're trying to assess, is there a problem with preload, contractility, or afterload? And the views that I use are threefold. They're the three highest yield views in a rescue exam. It's a mid-esophageal four-chamber view, a mid-esophageal long-axis view, and a transgastric mid-papillary short-axis view. And if you have a background in TTE, you'll realize that these views are analogous to the apical four-chamber view, the parasternal long-axis view, and the parasternal short-axis view. It's the same structures, just different orientations. So, again, trying to keep it simple up front and work through some of these anatomic frameworks quickly, there's a decision tree that I follow. And the first question I ask myself, is the LV systolic function depressed? Because that would make me think there could be a problem with contractility. If there's normal LV systolic function and the LV size is normal in diastole, then I start thinking if there could be a problem in the afterload category. And then The third one is if there's normal LV systolic function and there's an underfilled LV in diastole, something is preventing blood from reaching the left heart. So that would be a problem with preload. And I'll give the caveat here that there are exceptions to a number of these rules. There can be multiple problems in the same patient. Think about anaphylaxis that could cause a relative hypovolemia and a problem with preload in addition to low afterload. So there can be multiple of these things that coexist. But with that caveat, there's one more question that I ask about preload to further differentiate in that anatomic pathway. Whenever the LV is underfilled, I ask, or I look at the right ventricle next. If the right ventricle is dilated and hypokinetic, then I start thinking that pathology may be at the right ventricle or downstream towards the left side of the heart, where you think that there could be pressure overload from a PE, pulmonary hypertension, volume overload from tricuspid or pulmonic regurgitation, or from volume overload in general. The other side of that coin is if the LV is small and the RV is small with preserved function, then I think pathology very likely could be prior to the right ventricle. Hypovolemia, IVC compression or abdominal compartment syndrome, even tamponade compressing the right atrium. I will say the exception to this is lung pathology. So attention pneumothorax cannot be definitively diagnosed with TEE, and it can make a heart look hypovolemic during a TEE exam. So for this reason, I advocate that any machine that you're performing rescue TEE with also have a linear probe to be performing lung ultrasound. If you can quickly look for lung sliding, lung point, and other findings of attention pneumothorax, that's just one more tool you have in these rescue settings. So that's part one. This is the three views. I'm trying to discern these things from the three views before I go into part two, which is trying to be more thorough, performing more advanced views to solidify my diagnosis, ensure no findings are missed, and the standard basic perioperative TE exam that's offered by the American Society of Echocardiography. I think the article is from 2013, or the guideline was from 2013, is a standard 11-view exam. So you've already performed three views so far. But the reason these other views matter is because there's other things that you might not be able to catch with just those three views that are important in a rescue setting, and other advanced maneuvers you can do. Some of those things would be like diagnosing an aortic dissection, which you need other views of the aorta to see. Looking for a pulmonary embolism and getting better views of the main and right pulmonary artery. Being able to rule out contraindications to mechanical circulatory support is another step here, because sometimes the end pathway of care of some of these patients is on VA ECMO or with an Impella. So ruling out some of those contraindications is important. I mentioned linear probes and evaluating hypoxemia, but there's things you can do with TEE as well. And then the last, which you already mentioned, is further evaluating patients with hypovolemia or for fluid responsiveness. So that's where some of those things like LVOT, VTI variability, or even measuring cardiac output. If you want to get more advanced in rescue TEE, having some of those tools can help. They're not mandatory, but I say the more trained you are and the more tools you have, the more it can potentially aid you in a rescue setting.
And Andreas, what would be something you'd find on TEE that would make the patient a contraindication for ECMO?
Yeah, so things that I would consider, I'd want to evaluate the venous side and the aortic side. The venous side, I think about significant right atrial masses or thrombus, or even identifying Chiari networks that might make placing wires difficult. Sometimes wires can get caught in that and make locating your or placing the cannula is difficult. Then from the aortic side, things like severe aortic insufficiency, an acute aortic dissection, mobile plaques in the aorta. I've seen surgeons place them in a number of these situations because sometimes it's all you can do. But these are some of the contraindications I'd at least be looking for to try and alert whoever's cannulating the patient for VA ECMO.
Great. So what are some pro tips that you would give people who are going to try this out tomorrow? What should they keep in mind?
Yeah. One warning I would give is make sure no matter what, you're completing a full exam each time. I think it's really easy in emergency settings to find a diagnosis and then stop looking at that point. But as we mentioned already, multiple problems can coexist. So complete the full exam each time. And then if the clinical status changes, start over and do your exam from the beginning and do the full exam again, because there can be new findings. Patients are, you know, critically ill, and new things can be unveiled with time. Another tip I give is for you individually, and even for a hospital setting, thinking through the rate limiting steps of an exam. So the goal of a TE exam is from the decision to place a TE probe to the time of diagnosis and treatment, to make that time as short as possible. And one tip I was given a number of years ago that I just find so simple but so useful is a rate limiting step here can be turning on the TEE machine. So some TEE machines take 2 or 3 minutes to start. So if I'm called to a room, one thing I tell them before I hang up the phone is plug in the machine and turn it on, please, because I'm on my way. Or if it's me in the room, I want to plug the machine in and turn it on before I've even placed the probe. It's the first thing I do, not the last thing I do, because there's nothing more frustrating than trying to help a patient in emergency and your equipment's not working yet. And then I think the final tip I'd give is thinking about the rescue TE machine setup. I mentioned already having a linear probe available, and then even having a phased array probe as well. That way your rescue team, I think it's a more complete rescue setup when you can perform lung ultrasound, perform lines with it, central lines, arterial lines, using a phased array probe. If you're deciding between TTE or TEE, you can call for one machine that can accomplish all of these tasks.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right, let's say that someone is loving this. They say, I want to be able to do this, but man, I don't know how to do TEE. So give a little bit of an overview of like a beginner's guide to TEE. Where should people start? What should they keep in mind? What are some resources that could help them out?
Yeah, and I've been asked this question a bunch of times. I actually decided to make a podcast episode about it. It's episode 14, the best way to learn TEE and pass the basic or advanced PTE exam. And I go into a lot of detail, but I'll summarize some of the high points for you here. I think there's three main components to learning TE that I can think of. It's learning what to do with your hands, learning what to do with the machine, and then interpreting images. So as far as learning what to do with your hands, that would describe how to place a TE probe, or even probably more significantly, how to manipulate the probe to successfully obtain views. The resource that I would recommend, if your hospital has access to this, is a simulator, a TEE simulator. And because that's a good way in a low pressure environment where there's no time pressure related to a case moving forward, like can occur in a cardiac surgery operating room, to learn how to use your hands, manipulate the probe, how to get 2D views of three-dimensional structures, and then using this in conjunction with this is one of my favorite resources, but the Toronto General Hospital virtual TEE website. This is one of the best websites I've found at being able to show you all the TEE views and all the relevant anatomy. You can spin images. It just gives you a great understanding of a three-dimensional space. So with those two views, I'd recommend if you're very new to TEE, you can set up that website on an iPad or a tablet or even a computer and use a simulator to help practice until you can obtain all those views yourself with your hands. It's not required to have a simulator. You can do this with cases. I just find it's a little bit lower pressure, lower pace environment. You can take as much time as you want. So that's what to do with your hands. Thinking about what to do with a machine, this is, you use the word knobology to describe this. And the first time you look at a TE machine, it can kind of be like walking into an airport an airplane cockpit. Yeah. Where there's a million knobs and you're not sure what they do, but you got to know how to use them. But what you'll find is as you learn more and more about echocardiography, some of these things will start making sense. What color Doppler is, pulse wave Doppler, you know, all those different buttons and what they do. One suggestion I would give to help take a jump in your learning for the machine is ask your mentor or an attending you're working with if they wouldn't mind, if the clinical situation allows, to not touch the machine so your hands can do everything. Have them talk you through it, because there's a big advantage to building that muscle memory and seeing exactly how, when your hand touches this knob, here's how it changes my exam and my images, and just being able to relay that so you can do it more on your own next time. I mentioned the third one is interpreting images. This is the one I think that takes the longest time to learn. You're learning what normal cardiac anatomy looks like. But more importantly, the challenging one is making diagnoses, learning what abnormal cardiac anatomy looks like. And there's just no substitute for repetition and cases. So getting your hands on as many cases as you can perform with strong mentors and attendings that can help teach you, even if it's just reviewing cases after the fact, review your colleagues' cases. And then as you do more and more of that, the American Society of Echocardiography, the ASC, has some tremendous guidelines on their website. It's a free resource that can really help you take a jump in your knowledge, in addition to finding textbooks that can walk you through more advanced echo concepts.
Fabulous. All right. That's all amazing. Anything else you want to make sure people know before we move on?
No, I think that's it. My goal in trying to share all this is to communicate just how valuable TEE is to the perioperative clinician. That's the point of my podcast, is to be able to show people the ways it can be beneficial in their clinical care, even tomorrow, that they can make a big difference in patient care. The more they learn, the more they advance their skills in this, and that it can be done in a simple way or in a high yield way.
Fabulous. Well, this has been great. Let's turn to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. Andreas, what would you recommend the audience check out for fun?
Yeah, so I think my random recommendation would be that if you have never been a U.S. national park person, I would encourage making it your next vacation destination, especially considering some of the places in the Western United States, California, Utah, Arizona. So my family, we have a goal to go to all of them together. That's my wife and three young kids. We've been to about 25 of the 63 parks as a family. And there's just something that we find about finding fresh air, some of the most beautiful surroundings in the country, and maybe even no internet or cell service. That's just good for the soul. I know it's good for mine. So I think that's my random recommendation.
That's awesome. Do you have a favorite amongst the 25 you've been to?
Ooh, it's got to be Yosemite in California. There's just something, the magnitude of the sites there is just unparalleled in my opinion.
Yeah. Yosemite is really something. Have you been to Yellowstone?
I've been to Yellowstone, yeah. And I paired it with a trip to Glacier, which is probably the number two on my list. Nice. As well.
Fabulous. Yeah, I want to do more. I want to do more. That's a great recommendation. Yeah. Well, I'm going to recommend a much less lofty but enjoyable recommendation for a book that I'm in the middle of now, so I can't speak to how it ends, but I'm really enjoying it. It's called Buckeye by Patrick Ryan. It's a novel that is really sweeping. It starts in the end of World War II and kind of deals with two different families as their lives are intertwined throughout the next 50 years or so. It's really well written. It was recommended by the New York Times as one of their best books of this past year, and it's been a good read so far. So I recommend checking it out, Buckeye by Patrick Ryan. All right, Andreas, this has been great. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACCRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew.
Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Chidima Ikanti, Rachel Furman, and Mohammed Celeb are our production assistants and social media managers.
Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.